This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, I am very excited to have an extraordinary guest, someone who is in the process of changing the world, very gently and but very firmly, and with great determination. Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell is the discoverer, really, of the fact that unvoiced people and people on the autism spectrum are often fluently telepathic. Dr. Powell has been in clinical service for many, many years, certainly back all the way back into the 1990s, and has provided her services to very many people. We're going to talk about that. And we're also going to talk about what she knows about telepathy and how it might fit in even to the broader world. So I'd like to welcome Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell to Dreamland. Welcome, Diana. I'm very glad you're here.
Thank you.
Good. Well, at some point in your life, you discovered that unvoiced people on the autism spectrum were telepathic. When did that happen?
Back in 2011, 2012, that area of time, when I went to India to evaluate these savants because I was interested in savant syndrome. And I was invited over there to evaluate several children and to also give a day-long workshop based on my book, The ESP Enigma. And when I was over there testing savant skills, one of the parents said to me that their child was telepathic, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then another person said to me, well, all of these children are telepathic. And I said, really, that's very interesting. I said, well, if that's the case, then when I'm testing them for savant syndrome, that would be a problem, because if I'm testing to see if they're a mathematical savant and can give me the cube root of a six-digit number, almost instantaneously without deriving it because they can't do arithmetic, well, telepathy would be one way in which they could be getting the answer. So it was after that that I put out the hypothesis that these children could be telepathic. And it was after that I started hearing from families around the world who said, yes, you're right. I've been living with this for a period of time and I didn't know what to do with it. And I'm happy to see that somebody's actually taking it seriously and studying it.
Now, that could not have been an entirely acceptable thing to bring into the public space, given your scientific background. There must have been quite a bit of pushback from your colleagues.
I didn't bring it into... So after the medical board did what they did to me because I wrote a book on ESP, and it's not a book in which I claim that... I hadn't claimed that I... It's not about my own research. I'm not claiming that I proved ESP in the book. I'm not claiming that I have ESP. All I'm saying is that our models within physics would allow for this, because we realize at a quantum level that reality is very strange. And I knew that our model for neuroscience was so incomplete that it couldn't even explain basic things like what is consciousness. And so that combination made me look into the literature in parapsychology, where people have done experiments on things like telepathy. And I saw that there was a lot of people who were really credible, distinguished scientists over the past 100 years or so who had looked into these things and felt that there was something there. So that combination of those things said to me, as a scientist, I'm not going to dismiss these phenomena. And so that was what my book was about. And after I saw how the medical board regarded that, because in my profession, we're trained that somebody is mentally ill if they say that they have these abilities. And so that's really the standard by which people determine whether you're in reality or not. And then you get put on an antipsychotic if you're not. And so to have a psychiatrist saying that they thought that some of these things were possible, that's really problematic. And so I really laid kind of low in terms of my research over the last 12 years or so because of that. And I needed to make an income as a medical doctor. But I would research these cases and then present what I had to fellow scientists at, like a parapsychological association meeting and also at the science of consciousness meeting. And so I was wanting to, to show it to other scientists and just keep it at that level of discussion. I wasn't going public and making any kind of announcements. And it wasn't until I met Kai and she observed some of my experiments that she thought this really needs to go public in a big way.
And is that when you began to get into trouble? I very well remember. I knew Dr. John Mack, of course, who studied close encounter witnesses. He was at Harvard at the time, head of their department of psychiatry. And he ended up in a situation where he had his tenure challenged and his license to practice challenged. And he called me up one morning and said, they're trying to ruin my life. He was ambushed in a meeting with his superiors, or with his dean, rather, I forgot exactly what the title of the dean was, and a number of other people, and was just absolutely gobsmacked by what happened to him. Did anything similar happen to you, if I may ask?
Well, so let me make sure that you understand the sequence of events, because the issues I had with my medical board were back in 2010, and my book was published in December of 2008. And so it was after I had been given, I was basically on a book tour, and so more and more people were becoming aware of my book. And then that's when the board called me in and had me evaluated, and I had to prove that I didn't have a mental illness. That and so I got my license back. But so I practiced for the next 12 years and retired from medicine, knowing that the telepathy tapes, we were expecting a documentary to come out first, but knowing that there was, my research was going to become more public. And so I retired from the practice of medicine. And so I'm not, in trouble with anybody. I mean, as far as I know, all I'm doing is I'm researching a phenomenon that is getting reported by countless parents who are all experiencing this. And somebody's got to figure out what's going on here. Somebody's got to do the experiments. And because of the fact that I've been in this field for so long, it makes sense for me to be the one who does the experiments.
Well, exactly. It certainly does. You're so very knowledgeable, and you have, I understand the conventional neuroscience community. It doesn't accept the idea that there is any possible emanation from the brain or into it from the outside, except through the known senses. And you're dealing with something that is not a known sense. It's obviously there. It's a sense. Your research, in my opinion, and I'm not a scientist, but I'm not stupid either. It's pretty conclusive. And so something does happen. There is a connection. Can you talk to a little bit to what you think it might be now? What do you think might be happening between the unvoiced people and their caregivers and loved ones?
What do you mean, like, what do I think is the mechanism behind it? Is that what you're asking?
I know you certainly can't come to a final conclusion now, but you must be working in that direction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. So just to be clear, so what I have observed is I have observed children who, there are many children who can have their parent, or sometimes it's their teacher or their speech therapist, be thinking of a word or thinking of a random digit, and then having the intention of sending it to the child, and then the child will point out on a letter or a number board what it is that the person's thinking. And the majority of the people who report this phenomenon to me, that's the case. That's their means of communicating. And I've always known that would be very controversial, because you don't have enough of a distance between the person who knows the thing that's being transmitted and the person who's receiving it. I mean, they're right next to them with the letter board. And I always knew that would be problematic. And so I've focused predominantly on trying to find cases in which a child has advanced beyond that communication method onto typing individually into an iPad, or, you know, something called a talker, or even speaking occasionally. And so I've seen a couple of children who can type independently into a talker, and you get the same profound high accuracy. I mean, we're talking like 97% for random numbers. And I've also seen a child who could speak it. And I couldn't get, he was very young and energetic, and I couldn't get him to participate in the experiments more than just to do, say 2-3 digit numbers. But he still, he was very accurate. Actually, I did a 4-digit number with him. And so that's the basis. That's the basis of my thinking, that there really could be a there. But what needs to happen is that we really need to make sure that there's no cueing going on, because that's what the skeptics are saying. I understand why they're saying it. Doesn't mean that's what's happening, but we're working towards getting the conditions in which we can have them in, for example, separate rooms. Whatever we can to eliminate any kind of visual or auditory cueing. And it takes spending time with them, spending time with the parents to get them towards that, being able to do that, because these children are so they're so routine oriented. They need things to be done the same way over and over again. I mean, that's one of the things about somebody who's autistic. That's one of the diagnostic criteria, is that they're very repetitious. They don't like much change from what they're used to, and they're amazing pattern recognizers, and I think it's that combination of things that's involved in this process. But I think ultimately, if we're able to establish that they can do this at a distance, then the ramifications for what consciousness is and its relationship to the body and the brain are profound. It really would firmly take us out of the materialist model and say that consciousness does not reside within the skull. And in fact, I think that a better way of thinking about consciousness is that consciousness is actually something that the brain decodes, that we basically are surrounded by information that can come from different sources, and that our brain is actually decoding that information. But that some people get caught up in these psychological tapes where the information that they're dealing with is never outside of their own sort of repetitive thought process. I mean, people have looked at how much time does somebody spend having a novel thought versus having a repetitive thought? And the vast majority of people, if they really analyze it, take the time to sit back and look at their thought patterns, will say that, gosh, yeah, I have these thoughts on a regular basis. It's the same thing I say to myself.
Yeah, we're going to take a brief break, And when we get back, we'll be talking more and getting a little deeper into issues such as whether or not you can become telepathic. Is it possible to learn this? Dr. Powell's website is drdianehennessy.com. You can see it on the crawl below me. So visit Dr. Diane at drdianehennessy.com. It's a wonderful site, and it is full of information. And in particular, if you have an unvoiced person on the autism spectrum in your life, you might very well want to get into touch with Dr. Powell with the hope of enriching your family life experience. We'll be right back. My new book, The Fourth Mind, is on sale on Amazon for Kindle and paperback right now. The audiobook and hardcover are to come later this month. But why is it called The Fourth Mind? Why is that? Let me explain. First, I go into detail about the bodies, brains, anatomy, genetics, and beliefs of our visitors. And as you will see, there is reason to believe that this is accurate and the first time ever that this has been discussed in any significant detail with any degree of real accurate finish. Then I show that they have abilities like telepathy and levitation, which we don't. Or do we? In the second part of the book, I show how we did have those powers, but lost them during a huge catastrophe 12,000 years ago. Was it some kind of bizarre war? A natural catastrophe? Whatever it was, it nearly destroyed humankind and left us in a state of shock that we suffer from to this day. I call the powers we lost the fourth mind, and show how we can make a serious start at getting them back. Get the fourth mind. It's step one on our way to the stars. I want to make it. I want our children to make it. Mankind belongs as part of this cosmos, expressed into it like so many others across the reaches of the stars. Why not us? Of course we belong. The fourth mind. Get your copy today. And as always, I stand ready to answer your questions on unknowncountry.com in the comments section. Or send me an email at whitley@streber.com. I'm right here. I'm not a celebrity. I'm one of you. I'm just like you. Believe me. That's why I know we can all do this.
By the way, go to unknowncountry.com and get on the newsletter. It's easy to do. It's completely free. It comes out every Friday like clockwork, and you'll enjoy it. And it keeps you up to date with all the stuff going on around here, what the next Dreamland's going to be, what the next subscriber events are going to be, who's going to be in the subscriber video chat, because, you know, as subscribers, you get a lot of chances to chat personally with these guests. It happens all the time on UC. So go to UC and get started. UnknownCountry.com.
We're talking to Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell. Dr. Powell is a pioneer, discoverer of the fact that unvoiced people on the autism spectrum are sometimes, but not always, telepathic. Now, Dr. Diane, when I had Kai Dickens, who created the telepathy tapes and is your fellow angel in this revolution, she wanted to text one of the spellers during the show in order to get a piece of information that she didn't have that I had asked a question about. And when the text came back from the speller, and this all happened right on the show, not only did he answer the question, he also talked about what we were talking about on the show. But since the show is a recording, it's not possible. He couldn't have known anything about what we were talking about, but his response was quite extraordinary. Now, and so I want to start by asking you, are some of the spellers able, obviously some of them are able to read at distance, and perhaps he wasn't even aware that he was doing it. But what are the parameters, the dimensions of this as we understand it now?
These children have so many different abilities that really are all kind of fall into that category of non-local consciousness. So what they report is they've things like being able to see at a distance, you know, clairvoyance or remote viewing, depending upon what term you like for that, or seeing into the future. And a lot of them will report these precognitive visions that they have. And some of them report that they remember what it was like between lives or even remember a past life. Some of them, I'd say many of them, report, not only report seeing spirits, but they have done spontaneous mediumship readings when they were with somebody, such as a family member or a teacher that they were working with. They'd suddenly say, oh, you know, there's, you know, someone, you know, in the corner of the room who says his name is, you know, Joe, and he was your grandfather, and this is what he has to say. And it's like, gosh, I had a grandfather named Joe. How did you know that? And so so that kind of thing happens. And so a lot of these, I mean, one of the problems in terms of moving the needle in science is that these are really fascinating. They all are sort of, I think, saying the same thing, that really our idea of consciousness is incorrect, that there is a non-local consciousness that we can all tap into. That's what I think is probably going to end up being the consensus once the research is done. But some of these things that are reported, we're going to formally test them. In other words, it's been reported that these children that they're telepathic with one another. And so that's something that we're already starting to do, is to have them, the two children, in separate rooms and asking them to demonstrate conversation between themselves or send numbers to one another. So, and then there's protocols for studying mediumship, et cetera. So I see that there's a lot of different studies that could come out of this, because it does look like what is happening is more than telepathy, that there's something much larger than that that's going on.
Well, you know, I had an experience. Once I realized that this was possible, I began to, and I've had a lot of life experiences prior to this that were telepathic, because I'm a close encounter witness, as I'm sure you know, and anyone in this area is going to have telepathic experiences, which have been going on all of my life. It's not something I can consciously initiate, but it's something I'm fairly familiar with the experience of. And I was in Mexico last week and standing on a crowded street corner, and there was a non-speaker in front of me with her mother, and she looked about in her early teens, and we're getting ready to cross the street. And suddenly I became aware of this non-speaker in a different way. I can't really put into words what I mean. And she immediately turned around and smiled at me. And I thought, my goodness, she's telepathically connecting to me. And so the next thing I knew, she seemed a little uneasy. And so I tried to communicate the idea that I was, you know, that there was nothing to worry about, essentially. And there was an attempt to make verbal contact, word level contact, but I didn't speak Spanish and she didn't speak English. And this then happened. Suddenly I saw an image of a dog in my head, and a quite vivid image of a little dog, and the dog looked very much like the dog I'd had as a child. And then I saw an image of my dog with the other dog. And I realized that what she's done is she showed me her dog and compared it to my dog, which is only in my memory. And I thought, what in the world is actually going on here? Then she and her mother both turned around and smiled at me, and the light changed, and they went off across the street. Now, this implies the presence of an enormous level of consciousness that we are just barely beginning to touch. How does that comport with what you are discovering?
Your story, how does that fit with it? Or
level of the what I'm trying to communicate is that there is that this isn't just the trading of words between people without talking. There's something much bigger here. Because I thought it was just an extraordinary experience. And it was huge because it implies that she could go into my mind and find the image of my dog, compare it to her dog, show me her dog, and then my dog side by side as a way of communicating with me.
I think that a better term than telepathy, and this was a term that one of the mothers of one of these children, so the mother of Akhil, Manisha, said, is that she preferred that we use the word shared consciousness. And I think that that probably is a more accurate way of thinking about it. And so that implies that more can be transmitted, for lack of a better word, from one individual to another, because it can be transmitting information that you're not really consciously thinking about. I mean, that could be what the mediumship is entirely. It could be that the kid's just tapping into that, that unconscious material that's there. And so this idea of shared consciousness is, I think, one of the most compelling stories I've heard that makes me think that is this mother of an autistic girl who told me that her daughter goes through the archives in her consciousness. I mean, she says that she physically or feels it, and her daughter's going through the archives trying to find something within her mother's consciousness, and knows all kinds of things that she wasn't even thinking about. So it's exactly what you're talking about. And
yes, exactly. It sure is. Mm-hmm. Well, I find that absolutely fascinating because it implies, it implies that this level of consciousness is huge, and that we are all kind of almost filtering it in order to live our lives. And perhaps these kids don't filter like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's right, that they can't filter these things. And then the question is, why can't they filter them? You know, what is the filter mechanism? And that's what I've been interested in, is not only finding experimental data to show that these phenomena could be real, but it's also to then take those once you've established a baseline for that, then see how does it change as you change the conditions. In other words, is it something that drops off if they're further apart from one another? Would shared consciousness require some kind of overlap of your consciousness field? I mean, people talk about us having a consciousness field, which it varies in sort of the degree to which it extends outside of our body. But let's say, that it extends out of our body for 5 feet or 20 feet. Okay. Is it necessary to be within that consciousness field to have that overlap between the two for the sharing to occur?
That, of course, is an excellent question. friend of mine, a broadcaster called Ross Coulthart, recently had a special forces operator on his show called Jake Barber. I don't know if you are aware of this or not. Are you aware of this at all?
Well, yes. I mean, let me say that I've never met Jake Barber, and I had never even heard of him until that interview came out. But I've heard that he's publicly said that I'm on his team. And
I haven't heard that.
Yes. And
let's talk about that for a minute. that wasn't the direction I was going in, but,
I thought I'd better qualify it, though.
Yeah, go ahead.
So the way that I would, the way that I think is the accurate way to put it is that there's a parent company that it has a desire to do what SkyWatcher is doing. And I'm not 100% sure what all SkyWatcher is doing. I can't
ask you that question because I've never heard of it myself.
So. Yeah, I've never heard of it. I don't know what they're doing. What I know I'm doing is that I have been asked as a neuropsychiatrist who understands parapsychology as well. I'm on the board for the third time of the Parapsychological Association to study people that have extraordinary psi abilities. And so one of those individuals might be Jake Barber, because I mean, if he has a number of people, it sounds like he might, who said, yes, he has indeed been successful at doing what he does, then it's one of those opportunities to try to see, well, what's different about him? Why is it he's able to do this, which to most of us just sounds so extraordinary. It seems like it's impossible what he's saying he's doing. And so I'm part of a team of people studying the sort of neuropsychiatry behind some of the extraordinary abilities.
Well, in America, our culture is anyone who's even close to a team is on the team. So I can understand why he says you're on his team now. No, that wasn't the direction I was taking the question. I had no idea about any of this. But in any case, what I would like to ask is that he mentions what he calls psionics and operators who are involved in this. And I've heard, well, more than heard, I know a considerable amount about intuitives who engage with what they think of as non-human intelligence, which, as my listeners know, I'm not at all sure what exactly it is. And I've lived with it for most of my life. In any case, I was wondering if you've ever encountered people outside of the autism spectrum who aren't spellers, who are as fluently telepathic as the spellers, or have you even gone in that direction yet?
Well, I would say that I have fairly regularly received emails from people who are neurodivergent, which I think is a better term to use than autistic, because autism has all of these other things that it attaches on there. So, but we know that their brain processes information differently, and they're capable of communicating by typing into their computer and sending me an email or even speaking to me. Although for them, that form of communication is like breathing through a straw. It's so slow and painstaking because their brains process information in ways that's so rapid that to try to take that gestalt thinking process and then put it into words is hard. If you think about people who have these extraordinary experiences, these spiritual experiences, that they're frequently described as ineffable. And why do they use the term ineffable? It's because it's difficult to describe in terms. And it's difficult to describe in terms because it's something that you're experiencing, just to be simplistic, with more right brain dominance than left brain dominance. And so the left brain is the one that's involved in language. The right brain is one that's involved in intuition and gestalt thinking. And so if you're predominantly operating out of that, you know, out of the that decoding system, let's say, then to take that and to try to code it into something verbal is difficult. But there are people who can do that, and they do have a similar report of various experiences, like the ones who use the letterboards to communicate, in terms of spontaneous experiences of seeing spirits or seeing the future or et cetera. So yes, you do not have to be not autistic person, and you certainly don't have to be non-speaking in order to have these experiences.
Well, that's a relief because I know quite a few people who aren't or not noticeably neurodivergent who do have these abilities. I have met people who were profoundly neurodivergent and obviously to my eye on the autism spectrum, who weren't in any kind of institutional setting or in classes, or they were older people, and they were very fluent at this. You could easily communicate with them telepathically, and they're just out in the ordinary population. I've often wondered how many people are like that, and they don't come forward for obvious reasons, but they must be out there, and there must be quite a few. And I wonder, what's your sense of the degree that this actually penetrates the society in a kind of silent way, maybe? Do you have any intuition about that at all?
One of the things I want to say is that the people who have these really high sensitivities tend to be more reclusive. I was just talking with someone earlier today, and a lot of them can't go out in public. It's extremely uncomfortable. So they're not really integrated. So even though they can speak and they can use their bodies in ways that they could pass and be in public, it's so uncomfortable for them.
It's that agony.
They prefer not to.
I know some that live in little enclaves together. They do not have any support at all. And I've wondered if there would be any way of reaching them, because we do have, after all, people who are in our level of the world, who could give them support and help and all kinds of things. And I'm sure that if they were better known, but they're really very reclusive. And I've approached some of them whom I know a little bit, and they are adamantly opposed to this. They don't want it. And I'm wondering if there would be any, if you've ever considered if there might be any way of somehow breaking that barrier and approaching them, because I think there might be quite a few of them in the world.
What is this that they're opposed to? What is it that
they don't want to have any kind of professional help? They feel that will bring with it all kinds of conditions and possibly levels of notice that they want nothing to do with.
What I would say is that there's a tremendous lack of trust in the mental health profession because of its long history of pathologizing any of these things.
Precisely.
And that's one of the reasons why so many people reach out to me, I think, is because I'm not here to try to pathologize anybody. I'm here to try to understand, and to try to, because this is their reality.
Yes.
And what I've seen is, that a lot of them, have had the experience of being put on antipsychotics, and it didn't really change some of their reality. I mean, it just slowed them down so that they couldn't really function very well. And so many of them need to be able to connect with one another. So if they feel like they're within their like kind, then they actually can be quite social because it feels safe.
Yes. The people I'm referring to are mostly young adults. And I guess the oldest would be in their 40s and the youngest probably in their teens. And I know of some of them who live out in the desert here in Joshua Tree area. And I tried to connect with a couple who are like that, who are live together out there. And the husband was fairly open, but the wife, I mean, she might have, if I hadn't gotten out of there, she might have just come after me. She was really not, she was not interested. So I have to ask you this. If such a person were to get in touch with you, what would be your response, and what level of privacy could they count on?
Oh, I mean, I practiced as a psychiatrist for over 40 years. I mean, I operate on confidentiality. That to me is, I don't announce who people are unless I have their permission. I mean, and so over the years, most of the people who contacted me about their autistic kid, they weren't, there was, this was all pre-telepathy tapes. They didn't want to be, become famous. They just contacted me because they wanted to know, you know, what to do. They wanted to understand what was going on. And some of the kids, I think, that showed the most promise in terms of, demonstrating it, there's no way their parents would want them to be involved in a documentary. And,
none of these people are going to get anywhere near a documentary.
Yeah. And so I'm interested in two types of research. I mean, and what I mean by two types, it's the type of research in which the person is willing to have somebody who's a documentarian filming them, and those who just want to stay private, and but they want to contribute to science. And so I see those as two different populations. And I don't have the resources to help everybody who reaches out to me. I barely have the time to answer all the emails that I get. And so it really speaks to a need that is out there. A big need, an enormous need that is out there to have something that is an alternative to drugging these people up. And because, I mean, they're not a danger to anybody.
No, not at all. We need to take another break, Diane. I've gotten, and this happens every show, all my listeners love it. I forget about the breaks because I get so interested in the show. Anyway, this is break time. We're going to take another break. We'll be right back.
Hi, everyone. This is Kelly Chase. I'm Dreamland's new monthly guest host. You can catch me here on the last Friday of every month. If you're interested in checking out my other work, you can find that on my podcast, The UFO Rabbit Hole. On that show, I share my own personal research with deep dives into everything from historical cases to philosophical frameworks, as well as in-depth interviews with top thinkers in the field, like Jeffrey Kripal, Diana Walsh-Pasulka, Bernardo Kastrup, James Madden, and of course, Dreamland's own Whitley Strieber. You can find the UFO Rabbit Hole on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Just search for the UFO Rabbit Hole. And if you like what you hear and you want to go even further down the rabbit hole with me, I'd like to invite you to join my Patreon community. Patrons get perks like early access to new content and ad-free episodes. I host twice monthly patron-only Zoom calls where you can ask me questions, share your own thoughts, and connect with others. We also have a lively and active private Discord server where members host book clubs, happy hours, and just share their thoughts on all things anomalous without all the drama that's all too common on social media. It's a warm, open-minded, and vibrant community, and we'd love to have you join us. Memberships start at just $5 a month. You can sign up at patreon.com/UFO rabbit hole. That's patreon.com/UFO rabbit hole.
My new book, The Fourth Mind, is on sale on Amazon for Kindle and paperback right now. The audiobook and hardcover are to come later this month. But why is it called The Fourth Mind? Why is that? Let me explain. First, I go into detail about the bodies, brains, anatomy, genetics, and beliefs of our visitors. And as you will see, there is reason to believe that this is accurate and the first time ever that this has been discussed in any significant detail with any degree of real, accurate finish. Then I show that they have abilities like telepathy and levitation, which we don't. Or do we? In the second part of the book, I show how we did have those powers, but lost them during a huge catastrophe 12,000 years ago. Was it some kind of bizarre war? A natural catastrophe? Whatever it was, it nearly destroyed humankind and left us in a state of shock that we suffer from to this day. I call the powers we lost the fourth mind, and show how we can make a serious start at getting them back. Get the fourth mind. It's step one on our way to the stars. I want to make it. I want our children to make it. Mankind belongs as part of this cosmos, expressed into it like so many others across the reaches of the stars. Why not us? Of course we belong. The fourth mind. Get your copy today. And as always, I stand ready to answer your questions on unknowncountry.com in the comments section. Or send me an email at whitley@streber.com. I'm right here. I'm not a celebrity. I'm one of you. I'm just like you. Believe me. That's why I know we can all do this. We're talking to Dr. Diane Hennessy Powell. Her website, Dr. Diane Hennessy. Let me turn the ticker on. DrDianeHennessy.com. You can visit her there and engage with her there. And if you should be one of the people that we are talking about, have been talking about, you know who you are, and I know some of you watch the show. You can get into contact with Diane there. And if they do get into contact with you, Diane, I don't expect to hear about it, obviously. And I would ask you if you could tell me what would be your immediate response if you get, perhaps it would be an email from someone who says, I'm familiar with what Whitley was talking about and I'm interested in talking to you. Because of whatever reason they may give.
Well, what I need, because I, as I said, I'm getting a lot of emails. So what I would need is for them to really describe who they are and what it is that they who they are, what they've experienced, and you know what they would. What they hope to get out of being in contact with me, so that I can think about, you know, how I could either help them or research, you know, what it is that they're describing, just so that I know where to put them, what category to put them in, and what would be the appropriate way to spot. And then there are some people that I do set up a Zoom call with afterwards, just so that I can get a sense more of who they are. It depends. Right now, I mean, we're really under crunch to try to get the film made. Kai's under a lot of deadlines for that, and so I'm particularly interested in people who think that they can demonstrate telepathy with the kind of separation that we would like, and people who are interested in having any kind of free assessment of their brainwaves. for example, you know, what, you know, seeing, you know, what is, what's the brain waves of the child doing at the time that they're experiencing this shared consciousness, let's say, with the other individual. I mean, do we see a synchronization, for example, of their brain waves? So there's some people that might want to engage in that research, but they don't want to be filmed for a documentary, and that's fine. So that's my highest priority right now. But I do see that I do see things shifting, so that we're also going to be able to research people that have these abilities that don't fall within the parameters for the film.
Well, these people I'm talking about are mostly, in terms of the socially, they're semi-functional, and they tend to be very poor. And they live in generally in really, really very poor surroundings. They're often ill-fed, and they are, I think, often have diseases. And a lot of them are like schizophrenics. They smoke all the time. And do you know anything about why that is? I've studied that pretty extensively because I think it's obvious. I'm not telling you a lot about it. I don't want to say a lot about these people that because they're so sensitive, but they're struggling and they're really in trouble. And what I read was that nicotine, in the case of schizophrenia, when a person has voices in their head, the nicotine smooths, it doesn't stop the voices, but it lessens the intensity of the experience. These people have such voices in their heads, but they're the voices of the normal normal people around them. And that's why a lot of them live out in the desert, because they're farther away from most people and they don't have so much noise in their heads. Can you speak to that use of tobacco as a tranquilizer? Do you know anything about that?
When I was doing inpatient psychiatry, it was at a time when they still allowed smoking in hospitals, and particularly they allowed smoking in the psych ward. So it seemed like there was, frankly, everybody smoked. In terms of the neuropharmacology of it, nicotine works on the acetylcholine receptors, and the acetylcholine receptors are in opposition to dopamine receptors. And if you look at a lot of the antipsychotics that are used for treating schizophrenia, they're dampening down dopamine activity. So what the cigarettes are doing is that it's like a self-medication that's kind of reducing some of that hyperdopaminergic state, without it being something that sort of slows them down the way an antipsychotic does. Because unfortunately, these antipsychotics also work on other dopamine centers in the brain, you know, like the basal ganglia, and it causes a lot of difficulties with moving their bodies, for example.
Yes, I'm familiar with that. That's helpful to know, because I think that it's a major health issue for these people, because of, you know, obviously smoking's not healthy for you. Some of them have wanted, it's interesting, they wanted me to smoke because they said it would make it easier for them to communicate with me telepathically. Have you ever heard anything like that before?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard that. Makes me wonder if they're still talking about cigarettes here.
They wanted me to vape, actually, because it was obvious I wouldn't smoke cigarettes. Mm-hmm. And I won't do that either. They're important to me in my life, and I want to help them, and there's very little I can say about them. They're extremely sensitive. And so I'm going to go on now to other aspects of this conversation, and I would like to ask you now about your book and what was in it, because of course, and also if there's any place people can get it. I know they can't get it on Amazon right now.
No, they can't. They can get a signed copy from me through my website. And so so they can order it there. And then there's an audio book of it available on Amazon. And I'm trying to get the e-book back on there. And what's in the book? I mean, it's really written in a very scholarly way. I mean, it was reviewed favorably by my medical school. And it also is in libraries across the U.S. And so what was in it was that I basically said what I said earlier, is that I talked about the model in neuroscience and why it's incomplete, and why we can't exclude ESP as a possibility based on that. Then I talked about basically physics from over a century ago that shows us that our reality that we perceive is really different from what our senses tell us is reality is different from what physics is telling us. For example, that our perception of time as an arrow that only moves in one direction, moves forward, is incorrect. I mean, Einstein said our sense of time is an illusion. And so I talk about things like that. And then I also talk about about the research that has been done by other scientists, such as the scientists at Stanford Research Institute, showing that different types of psychic abilities have been demonstrated to a significant level using statistical analysis, but there's also qualitative analysis as well. And so I go through each one of the different phenomena with the parapsychology studies and talk about some of the evidence for it. And then I talk about who it is that seems to report these experiences the most, and how their brain activity, based on what I know as a psychiatrist, the brain activity is more similar to the brain activity of somebody in dreaming sleep. And that's one of the reasons why I hypothesize that autistic children, particularly ones who get designated as savants, would be the most likely to demonstrate psychic abilities, because they're, if you look at savant skills, they're very right hemisphere oriented, and they have left hemisphere deficits. And when we're in dreaming sleep, our right hemisphere is what's dominant, and our left hemisphere shuts down. And so so those are the kinds of things that I talk about in the book.
Wow, I've got to read it. And folks, I urge you to go to drdianehennessy.com and get a copy. I think we all need to read it or listen to the Audible. I know a lot of people nowadays listen to audiobooks, because when I publish a book, the first thing everyone says is, where's the audiobook? And incidentally, those of you who are interested in my new book, the audiobook should be out in about 2 weeks. My book is on Amazon. And in any case, hopefully your book will be back on Amazon soon. But get it now, folks, because I'm sure it's extremely empowering. And this is important, because we live in a culture that is constantly telling us something about ourselves that's not true. That we are confined to this is all we are. But we're not. We're much more. We're much more. And Diane knows it. And Diane, do you have any telepathic contact with any of the spellers that you work with? I know some of their caregivers do.
Oh, that's an interesting question. But I haven't had an opportunity to spend as much time with them. But I will say that I can read people pretty well, and there have been times when I've said something and I see them light up afterwards. They're like, yeah, you're right, you know. And so but I don't know what I'd label that, but I just have I get these intuitive insights. And that's something that I did as a psychotherapist with people. I would get this intuitive insight and I would tell them what it was that I thought, and they're like, wow, and so I've had people say that they think that I read minds, but I don't know that I'd go out there and say that I do.
Yeah, I know the feeling, that kind of intuition. I've always. Well, my father was telepathic, frankly. He had to have been. He and his brother were involved with the government all of their lives. And his brother was an air materiel and worked on the Roswell incident at Wright Field in Dayton, Ohio, and then with the Atomic Energy Commission when that project was moved to the Atomic Energy Commission. And so it's been in my life, and I think that there are people in the outside world who are not, who my father was normally voiced, but he certainly had noticeable and quite obvious telepathic skills, to my great horror when I was a little boy. In any case, but he was quite kind about it. I think we've reached the end of our free part of the show, and if you could go on with us for a little bit longer, there are a few other questions that I think I would very much like to ask about whether or not and how people who are interested in this and would like to become telepathic themselves, if there's any avenue they could, any way that you any suggestions you have. So the free part of the show will end now, and in a moment we will continue on for our subscribers.
Thank you for listening. Dreamland is brought to you by Unknown Country and its family of subscribers. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our site coordinator is Amy Safrankova. The founder of UnknownCountry.com is Ann Strieber. I'm Whitley Strieber, your host for Dreamland.